This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Heather Claiborne, in this week for George Levesque. You may have missed it, but last Tuesday, when a lot of people were focused on Texas's primary election, Abilene's leaders presented the annual State of the City address. What used to be a speech delivered in the city council chambers has become a slick presentation with AI-enhanced videos, special guests, and lots of balloons, all delivered on a stage in front of a live audience. Mayor Weldon Hurt is here to give us the cliff notes. Mayor, welcome again to the West Texas Dispatch.
Man, it's so good to be here today.
Of course, so much conversation around Abilene links back to the data center. You had Misty Mayo, the president of the Development Corporation of Abilene, along with the leaders from Lancium and Caruso, talk about where the Stargate project is.
Well, even on, I think they're kind of they're not stepping back from the development that they've already started. So let's start with the Lancium project, which is the project in Northwest Abilene. That's eight buildings that are under construction now. The plans are to continue to finish those eight buildings and maybe bring in some other tenants there. But when they're talking about slow down on the expansion, that's the expansion of building 9 and 10 and potentially other buildings that were going to be built after these original eight. So they're going to finish the original eight. There is going to be a data center complex out there. I think they're going to wait to see what tenants are going to come and who's going to invest in them before they make more expansions.
When Jay Moore was describing moments of growth over time, he said Lake Fort Phantom was key to Abilene's ability to grow at key points over this 145 years, and the phrase water is king came up. There's a lot of concern that the data centers are going to demand too much, both of local water resources and energy. I want to play a clip from Lancium's Michael McNamara about this.
The data center is a 500 gallon per minute allocation, all sustainably that we've all talked about. The city of Abilene uses 16,000 gallons per minute, I think. And I looked for last month and it was the whole data center, 8,000 people, was 10 gallons a minute. And I spilled guacamole on my shirt at El Phoenix at lunch and I used more water on my shirt getting the stain out than the data center did.
Are the community's concerns about resources valid?
Historically, data centers have consumed a lot of water. There's a lot of heat. There's a lot of evaporation. But the technology on these new data centers was what is called a closed-loop system. There is no evaporation. And so with general use, it takes a lot of water to fill them and then to flush them, keep them clean. But there's no evaporation, so there's not a lot of long-term use. Those eight buildings will use on the high end about 20 million gallons of water annually. Okay. Abilene and its wholesale customers use between 23 and 25 million gallons a day. So it would rank them in below, you know, when you take the top 100 users of water in Abilene and wholesale customers, they would be ranked below 50.
Misty Mayo talked about other opportunities that this project is bringing. We know about the Bass Pro Shopping Center, and there are others. For those who missed the presentation, can you give us some of the highlights?
Everybody is kind of looking at the data centers for our population growth, but Texas is growing, and Abilene has more natural growth than we had, you know, the previous 30 years. You know, when you talk about a 1% growth, and now we're looking at a 3 to 4% population growth. So just the growth of that, you know, the Bass Pro Shop is, you know, very excited. That will also come with another shopping center that ties into that, that will bring about six new restaurants and eight new retail there. Just in that area alone. And so, you know, we're growing. There's going to be opportunities for developers. You're going to see bigger stores, bigger name stores coming to Abilene because we've just never had that population, and our population is finally fitting the criteria for their numbers.
The other big project coming in the near future to Abilene is bombers coming to Dyess as the rest of the B-1 bombers get relocated here. Maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people over the next few years. And then the B-21 also going to bring thousands to Abilene. The Vice President of Military Affairs Committee for the Abilene Chamber of Commerce, Major General John Nichols, described the sound of jets overhead as both the sound of freedom and the sound of money. From the perspective of the impact on Abilene, tell us about the projections for how that's going to impact the city's reputation and the local economy.
what we know is that we are desperately in a housing shortage as far as rentals go and as far as housing for these young airmen and those ones that are going to be coming. So you're going to have an additional increase first with the B-1. So as the B-21s start being stationed at other bases, all of the B-1s that are active will come to Abilene. So we'll have about 40 B-1s. That will bring about 3,500 to 3,800 more personnel with just the B-1. Then as we transition into the B-21, the B-1s are not going to go away until we get B-21s in a sufficient number. So you're looking at about, you know, we've heard different numbers, but the average I hear is about 5,800 personnel for the B-21. And so the opportunity for growth there, because we're going to have these people that are living in Abilene. We just know right now that we're desperately short on rental housing, and we're working ways with developers and developable land, availability of land in Abilene right now, so that we can work with developers to encourage that type building.
So both bombers coming to Dyess and the AI data center and other growth are putting pressure on Abilene's housing market. Mike Powell of Girard Real Estate and Ken Hogan with the Abilene Association of Realtors joined you on stage to talk about the housing situation. Mike Powell specializes in rentals, and here's some of what he had to say.
We've got under 100 rental properties in the Abilene MLS available right now. And as one of the larger firms here in Abilene, we have roughly 35% of the market share of residential rentals. We're sitting at 25 this morning available. We're taking in 200 plus applications a month, the lease properties. You can quickly do the math that those don't work. So we are seeing that, and that's why prices are going up. The demand is just extremely high.
I hear about it from my staff. There are three universities in town. Students need affordable housing. Major General Nichols wants some dedicated affordable housing for airmen, and the general population needs affordable housing. Tell us what's going on to address what many people are calling a housing crisis.
Well, you know, it's economics. It's supply and demand. And what we're all trying to do is deal with this bubble of when the construction workers are leaving. You know, our universities are growing. They're not growing at huge paces, but they're growing about like the city is. We have growth in our universities, and that housing is needed there. It's needed for our residents, because what we see is affordable housing, people that could afford the rents they were in, they may have just been able to barely afford it. And now, at the end of their lease terms, they're being asked to move out so they can get rent increases. So we're just reaching out to developers. We're trying to find all the available land. We're trying to speed up the platting process and the permit process. We have to protect our city and our citizens, but we are trying to speed that process up. Where you can get a plat or developable area in Abilene, you can go through the paperwork in about 6 weeks. In Austin, that still takes 6 to 9 months. So we're ahead of the game, but we want to be as efficient as we can about getting that process and working with these developers to get some new units built.
Do you think there's been some confusion about the kind of temporary RV park that is being added in city limits? Anything you want to clear up for people on that?
That is for employees of the Vantage Data Center, the Shackelford County Data Center only. The other thing is there is a term on that, and when they are not using that facility, that 1,000 units, approximately 1,000 units for Vantage Data Center employees anymore, they have to take it all down. The other thing is we zone that, but that is privately owned property. They also have an additional agreement with the landowner that that's what will happen to that property. So those park models, probably in 10 to 15 years, they'll put the wheels back on them and move them out.
So from your perspective, as you look at the city's resources, what are the projections for Abilene as far as just, you know, your budgeting? Are you expecting to have a lot more to spend on things around Abilene?
With this new income coming in from data centers, it kind of creates a roller coaster effect, because your taxable income goes up and down. You also see a surge of sales tax. But what you have to be really careful about doing is not using sales tax, that one-time money. You don't want to use it on something that you're going to have to pay for the next year and the next year and the next year. So what we want to do is look at some one-time spends, how we're going to get, you know, we don't know how much money that's going to be yet. It's going to be several million. We know that. But what's going to be the best use for the one-time spend on those? Of course, a lot of people say, well, you know, you could put it into a savings account and keep it. Municipalities can't do that. We don't get to have a savings account. So we have to use it. We just have to be very careful because everybody in the world is going to say, hey, you can do this, you can do this. The main thing is you don't want to create recurring debt, but you want to do it that something that's going to benefit the citizens.
One of the things that will benefit the citizens is the new airport. Update on, you know, the timeline and all of the construction that's coming for that.
You know, the thing about a municipal project is it doesn't move as fast as other projects, and I admit that. But it's in design. I think you should start actually seeing some preliminary construction where you see something happening within 90 days. And then about a year and a half after construction starts, it'll be finished. Now, while you're on that, and I'm glad you asked that, so we've got a new airline coming starting March 17th, next week. We're going to have direct flights to Denver twice a day and a direct flight to Houston. While we're adding these additional flights, we're going to be under construction, so we ask everybody to be cheerleaders and help us out in this way and be patient as we move through this construction process. I also want to add that we'll have a direct flight to Tucson starting in May.
Well, that's good news for folks who right. are heading different places, and we appreciate the fact that all of these things are going to have some growing pains along with them, and we appreciate you coming in to tell us about it.
Well, it's always good to be here. I always appreciate the opportunity to be here and appreciate everything you all do, your willingness to share things with West Texans in a very positive way.
If you missed the State of the City address, you can catch the full presentation on the city's website, AbilineTX.gov. This is the West Texas Dispatch. There's never a good time for farmers to find a new pest among their crops, but a tiny invasive insect has struck Texas rice growers at a particularly inopportune time. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
Whenever a pest gets into Timothy Gertson's rice fields, he normally tries to take care of it as soon as possible. But last year, when an insect infestation hit a few hundred acres of his west of Houston, he didn't do anything.
We don't have money in the budget to kill this thing anyway, and we don't really have anything that's killing it.
The pest is called the rice delf acid, and it decimated crops across Texas and the Southeast in 2025. Researchers have not found a way to control it, and it's become a problem at a time when growing rice was already especially hard.
The problem is our prices have absolutely tanked. We have the worst economic conditions since I started farming in by far.
Even without the pest, Gertson says it will be extremely difficult to make a profit on rice in 2026 because of low prices and high growing costs.
Fertilizer and insecticides and all our crop protectants just go up every year. Seed costs go up every year.
That's LG Ron, who's grown rice southwest of Houston for 50 years. Growers in the South can typically grow two rice crops in a single season, a main crop and a second ratoon crop, as it's called. But last year, a rice delf acid infestation wiped out almost all of Ron's ratoon crop.
It's 100% of my profit. So without the ratoon crop, I'm not going to make money for the year in my operation.
The little bug that caused Ron so much trouble is native to Central and South America. Researchers think it was likely blown north by high winds and established a resident population in the U.S. over time. At just a quarter-inch long, full-grown, rice delf acids are hard to see. Lena Berniola, a rice entomologist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, said it's easy to look at a field and think it's clear of them.
But then the week later, you will see that the pest was there and already had an impact in your crop.
Rice delf acids damage plants by sucking out their sap. Texas farmers have known about them for about a decade, but they haven't caused any major damage until 2025, when that changed in a big way.
In 2025, Texas experienced much larger infestations than ever. Pretty much every single field had a presence of a rice delf acid.
So far, none of the pesticides approved for rice in the U.S. have effectively controlled the delf acid. Sam Rustin is an agronomist for the Texas A&M Extension. He's been trying to find new chemical treatments for the bug.
We are literally taking shots in the dark at this point and just testing whatever we can, just trying anything we really can at this point.
The EPA granted emergency approvals last year for two chemical treatments, but they did not work as well as hoped.
They're not worth a shit. you want my personal opinion on them. That's why I'm in the hole that I'm in, because those two products are not performing.
Rustem says he gets calls from growers with questions about the Delphacid every day, and he wishes he had better advice to give them. Even if he had a good pesticide recommendation, though, some farmers may not be able to afford to spray. An analysis from Southern Ag Today showed rice growers in Texas, Arkansas, Missouri, and Mississippi probably would not break even in 2025, even with forthcoming financial assistance from the Trump administration.
2026 is scary. You know, if we can't get an increase in demand, it's going to be challenging for our rice producers from a cash flow standpoint.
That's Michael Deliberto, an agricultural policy professor at Louisiana State University. One of the variables affecting the price is increased supply from countries such as India, which until recently had a ban on exporting rice.
We've seen a lot of competition in the export market, and some of that is due to larger crops in South America. Some of that increased competition is bumper crops in Asia year after year.
These global trade patterns plus the pest mean it is hard for Texas growers to know how much rice to plant in 2026, if any. Timothy Gertson considered skipping this season altogether, but eventually opted to grow 750 acres of jasmine rice, about half his normal acreage. He won't make a profit.
I'm not paying myself, really, but I am paying my employees. And that's at least on our farm, it's extremely important. We have great guys. We want to keep them around.
He's also a little optimistic about a possible new pesticide option. The EPA is now evaluating a chemical called Corrier for U.S. rice on an emergency basis. It's unclear, though, whether the federal agency will approve the application before planting season begins around March.
We're not real sure what to expect this year, even if we have Corrier in our arsenal to be able to help control them.
Longtime rice farmer L.G. Ron plans to plant his normal 1,000 or so acres and cross his fingers.
I'd worked up all the fields like a normal year would be, and so I've decided to go ahead with all of that. I'm hoping for good yields, and then I'm hoping that the price maybe will turn around next crop year.
I'm Michael Marks.
Right near El Paso, the biggest international livestock crossing in the country is usually bustling with activity. It's a center for the U.S.-Mexico cattle trade. The livestock crossing has been quiet for months. The New World screwworm has led to a ban on Mexican cattle. The flesh-eating parasite has been detected in parts of Mexico, and that's led to a ban on cattle from our neighboring country. That has far-reaching consequences on the beef industry here in the U.S. The Texas Standard's Angela Kocherga spoke with Clint Peck, who writes for Beef Magazine.
Explain just how integrated the U.S. and Mexico are when it comes to cattle.
A lot of the cattle feedlots in the southwest of the U.S., of New Mexico, Arizona, even over into California, Texas, have relied for 60 or 70 years on a supply of feeder cattle out of Mexico. A lot of that has been to fill seasonal supplies. When native cattle aren't available, they can dig into the Mexican feeder cattle and fill those feedlots to graze the winter wheat pastures, and they go then into our supply chain.
So real heavy dependence on that. And I understand one feedlot in Texas is closed because cattle from Mexico can't cross the border. What happened?
Lubbock Feeders did announce their closure, and one of the reasons that we assume, and it hasn't exactly been stated by the owners and managers of Lubbock Feeders, but the figures are pointing towards a lack of supply from Mexico. And that's exacerbated, obviously, by a shortage of feeder cattle throughout the U.S., so the native cattle. We have the lowest inventory of beef cows in something like 60 or 70 years. Couple that with the closure of the Mexican border, and feedlots across, especially the southwest, are short of cattle. And to keep a feedlot open, you have to have cows.
Well, how worried are the folks you spoke to about additional feedlots closing?
They're concerned that the lack of feeder cattle in general is just making it so that they can't find enough cattle to keep their feed yards open. Some are running at 60% capacity. 80 to 90% is normal. But at 60% of capacity, these guys just can't make it.
So is there an argument to be made that perhaps closing the border to all cattle from Mexico is overkill? I mean, there are certain state border states in Mexico, like Sonora and Chihuahua, where we don't have the New World screwworm detected.
And the people I'm talking with, feeders and the cattle traders, are saying that there's really not a whole lot of science-based reason to keep that border closed because of the screwworm threat. Sonora, Chihuahua, are isolated, and there are barrier zones between areas that have active cases of screwworm. And they believe that because there's little or no threat of the screwworms infecting their cattle and thus crossing the border, that the border should be open, and it's more political than it is scientific. And we also have reports that the existing feedlots in Mexico are bursting at the seams with cattle, and they're building new feedlots as we go. The other part of that, Angela, is that the meat packing industry in Mexico is ramping up. And in effect, what's happening then is the Mexicans will feed these cattle, process them. They'll put the meat in boxes or swinging carcasses, and that meat will come north across the border. At the same time, when U.S. feeders and packers sorely need more cattle to fill their pipelines.
That's the Texas Standard's Angela Kacherga speaking with Clint Peck, who writes for Beef Magazine. This is the West Texas Dispatch on KACU. I'm Heather Claiborne. When John O'Leary was 9 years old, he caused an explosion while playing with fire and gasoline that burned 100% of his body. Doctors gave him a 1% chance to live. He not only survived, but has gone on to work to inspire people to accept their own imperfections and to celebrate the gift of life. O'Leary is coming to Abilene later this month to share his story at an event sponsored by the Laura W. Bush Institute for Women's Health. Pearl Merritt is the regional director for the Laura W. Bush Institute for Women's Health, which is at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Welcome to the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here today.
Well, John O'Leary's story may be familiar from the movie Soul on Fire, but for those who haven't read one of his books or seen the movie, can you tell us a little bit about him?
When he was 9 years old is actually when he did suffer that traumatic burns that covered 100% of his body. Despite the odds, he survived. And rather than dwelling on his tragedy, as a lot of people would, O'Leary embraced what happened to him, and he dedicated his life to inspiring others and accepting imperfections and really celebrating the life they were given.
And so what is this event that the Laura Bush Institute is hosting? Is this a fundraiser? Is this just an event to bring the community together? Tell us more about the event.
Once a year, we do have a major event, a fundraiser, where we bring someone that's just totally outstanding to Abilene. And we will have a wonderful evening. Again, he is a best-selling author, and so he, again, will talk about his miraculous survivor. Right. And there are so many people that have already seen the movie. I saw the movie on Netflix, Soul on Fire. And it was just, it really does transform your life when you are just looking at his story. So we're very fortunate that he will be at this event. It will be at the Abilene Country Club on March the 31st. The dinner starts at 6:30. We have a VIP reception prior to that. And people in town sponsor a table, and we already have quite a few people already signed up that are going to be there. And, you know, it makes a difference that this is such a tragedy. And even Jack Buck, the legendary sportscaster for the Cardinals, he actually helped transform John into this, his story, into a mission of hope, resilience and gratitude. And he'll be talking about his idol, Jack Buck, who inspired him. And when he did find out what had happened, he made it a point to go to the hospital right then. And he was with John O'Leary. And every day he would come by John O'Leary was bandaged up. All you could see were his eyes. And he would talk to him, and Jack would just give him hope, which we all need hope. But I think one of the great things about his story, he also, it shows where he was in the hospital and how even the housekeepers came together. His room had to be sanitized so he did not get an infection. And how important their role is, and the physical therapist, the people that were there helping him, really helped him and inspired him. And it just shows you how important we each play a role in helping people get better. And so the fact that he just had a 1% survival rate, there were so many people rooting for him and wanting him to be fine, and he lived.
The title of the event is John O'Leary, Live Inspired. What would you say the goal is for the event as far as, you know, what are organizers hoping that the audience will take away?
You know, we all have tragedy in our life. Everyone does. And the hope is that you're not just going to live that the rest of your life. Find out what the hope is, what you have to live for. So I think the takeaway is just so inspiring, and it renews your faith in actually humanity, how good people are. And it's just a very inspiring story, and especially for those people that have maybe experience something similar to this or another severe tragedy, traumatic tragedy, it inspires them and gives them hope.
The Laura W. Bush Institute for Women's Health at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center describes its work as empowering and educating women. Tell us a little bit more about the organization and what this fundraiser will do for the work that they're doing here in Abilene.
Sure. So I'm the director also of the Laura Bush Institute here, and we want to really help women and children, and we always have a lunch and learn 2 times a year. And we have a speaker that will come to Abilene. There's just a nominal fee just for lunch, which is usually $25. But we have had large groups of women that come, and they're just so inspired because of the different speakers we've had, the various. We've had speakers talk about mental health issues, and that was, you know, that is so touching because there's so many problems and people experiencing mental health issues. So our mission is to help people and have an event where they can come together with people that have similar problems. And so anyway, basically we have that twice a year, and then our large fundraiser. We also do projects with children, also the Alliance for Women and Children. We work partner with them with some of their events. We also partner with Hendrick Healthcare System. They are our major partner. And so many times when they have events, we sponsor those. So Hendrick Health System is very important to our success.
Are people able to buy just a single ticket, or would they need to be part of a table for the John O'Leary event?
We usually encourage the table events, but there's many people. I talked to a lady yesterday, and she's single, and she said, I don't have anybody to go with. And so we are going to do a few individual tickets.
Anything else that you think the community should know?
You know, I just want to say that Abilene is such a wonderful community, giving community. And anytime we have events, they come out and they are there with us, involved with us, because they have the same mission that we do. So we're looking forward to that wonderful event on March the 31st.
Well, Pearl, thank you so much for coming and telling us about it.
Thank you.
Pearl Merritt is the regional director for the Laura W. Bush Institute for Women's Health. The John O'Leary Live Inspired event will take place at the Abilene Country Club on March 31st. You can find more information about the event on the Laura W. Bush Institute for Women's Health website. It's time for West Texas Roots. At February's Texas Farm, Ranch, and Wildlife Expo, our team enjoyed making new friends and gathering stories from all around West Texas. Keith Pascal takes us back to his younger years when he needed to keep his truck radio turned off while he transported dynamite. He also shared memories of his family's misnamed horse, Speedy.
I grew up in Shelp, and they were building the flood control dam. We had the first one built in this area on my grandfather's place, 1966. Anyway, they went to another place when they got through there that's about 2 miles west of us, and they changed from using the cables for blasting. They went to electronics, and the crazy guy that was doing the blasting, he's an alcoholic like most of them, and he goes, I'm not a fan of those. And they said, well, this is the way everything's going. So they go out there, and they had this old box van, and they put a divider plate in the middle of it, a steel plate. They put the blasting caps up front, put the fertilizer and stuff in the back, keep it separated. Didn't work real well. They had it parked out on the hill, kind of away from the lake where they were building it, and there was one of the big dirt movers going across the dam, which is about halfway built up, and he's going across there. Dice Air Force plane flew over, and it went boom. The concussion knocked that earth mover off the backside of the dam. And the guy says, see, I told you that I don't like that stuff. Yeah, he got a surprise. Yeah, there was lots of excitements out there. We had some crazy ones. And I remember the kids. They were from Brownwood. There was two boys and a dad that drove the old cable dirt movers. They didn't want you to drive them fast because they'd get the bounce and the cable would snap and then that blade would drop in the ground and you stopped. Of course, the tire is behind you, that big tire that's about 4 foot wide. Well, they were known to be alcoholics too, but the boys was in there and they always made them strap down. And he was going too fast on there, loaded. Cable snapped. It took the seat and all, ripped it out of the seat. He went through the plexiglass window, and it threw him out on the ground. And when he went to raise his head up, there was the tire. He was sober for a few days. We'd always go out with my grandfather. He rode the pastures twice a day, always. Well, the grandkids would pile on an old horse called Speedy. We'd pile about 5 kids on that thing. Nothing Speedy about it. But he was the best pasture horse. And if he started crying, he just stopped. Speedy, he was always smart. But we'd push him over to the fence or a tree or something, and kids start piling him out in the pasture. You just let him go run around. But he'd wait for the last kid to get on, and then just by the time you start to get over, he'd just tide step. But he got so old that he'd fall asleep while you just walk in the pasture. Every day it was the same trail. You never steered him. You just look around for the sheep and the cows, you know, sitting there all right. And he just walked up, and he got to where that his old head go down like that, and you get ready, he's fixing to fall asleep. But he'd still be walking. Well, Dad Jake just, he'd lean this way, and the horse would lean that way. And then in a minute, he'd need to go back the other way. He'd lean over on that side. The horse would lean that way. Well, my dad got on him one day, and he's walking on him, and he forgot. And the horse run into a cedar tree. And he turned around and looks back at him. And he said, I'm sorry, Speedy. I forgot you were asleep. Yeah, he lived 24.
We recorded Keith Pascal's story at the Taylor County Expo Center. This This is the West Texas Dispatch. On Saturday, March 21st, the Abilene Philharmonic will present their last Masterworks concert of the season, Bizet's Carmen. The opera is a tragedy that tells the story of a Spanish soldier who's seduced by a free-spirited Romani woman. After Carmen's affections turn toward another, jealousy leads to murder. Greg Strawn sat down with Maestro David Itkin, music director and conductor of the Abilene Philharmonic, to talk about next week's show.
David, welcome.
Thank you.
So to put on a performance of Carmen, you have to have a great slate of vocalists, a choir, a stellar orchestra. I know there will be a few audience favorites among the soloists, and that we'll get to that in just a moment. But my first question to you is this. Why Carmen? Why pick this for the final masterwork in the season 75?
Well, I've done a lot of concert opera in my life, but never here in Abilene. And that was a terrible vacuum that we needed to fill. And I hope to fill it more in coming years, because concert opera is very popular. And in fact, during COVID, just at the end of COVID, we did a survey of our audience to just be sure we were taking the pulse of our audience and what they really wanted to hear. And we put a dozen or a couple dozen possible Masterworks type programs. And we said, tick off the ones that really speak to you, that you would really like to hear. Because we didn't know what we would get back.
Sure.
And some of the responses were surprising, and that was a good thing because that's why we did it.
Great.
And one of the surprises was the overwhelming desire to see a concert Carmen.
Great.
And we picked Carmen as the sort of the poster child for a concert opera because it is a very famous piece. It is, in fact, I think, the most performed opera in history. And everybody knows the big tunes, but there's lots of other great music that we don't know as well.
Yeah.
And so to bring it here and have this incredible cast that we've put together for this is going to be super exciting. We boiled it down to just under 2 hours.
Okay.
The opera takes closer to three in real life. And so we think that's going to be a manageable bite, but you still get all of the great music. You get all of the important story elements.
Right. Fantastic. I know there's a lot of music to choose from. Do you have a favorite
moment? No.
From this absolutely
All right, I'm going to pick an off-center piece.
Deep cut.
I'm going to go deep cut because we all know the Toreador song and we know the Habanera and we know the Seguidilla and all these super famous tunes. Yep. So I'm going to pick the piece that will actually end the first half of our presentation, which is the quintet.
Ah, I was hoping you would say that.
This stunning, sparkling piece. For the Carmen and her two friends and the two smugglers.
Yep.
And they're having a conversation about what's going to happen next in their smuggling activities. And they're having, it's not only an incredibly sparkling piece of music and a tour de force for the five singers, but it's also a very entertaining lyric because they're talking about the fact that nobody take offense at this. I didn't write this. Okay. I just quote it. I'm the messenger, not the author. They're talking about how when you're going to do something devious like smuggling, you need to be sure and have women with you.
Right, right.
Because they're the key to making it all work.
All of the plans,
all the plans
laid out here.
All the plans hinge on whether or not you have women in your smuggling group.
Yep.
And you can take that to mean whatever you want.
And they do in this performance.
And they do.
And we'll see what happens on the second half of the show, which, spoiler alert, maybe not everything works out.
Maybe not everything works out like they planned.
David, thanks so much for being here and giving us your conductor's notes. David Itkin will conduct the Abilene Philharmonic in their last Masterworks concert of the season, March 21st. At 7:30 p.m. at the Abilene Civic Center. You can find out more information about this performance and how to get tickets on our website, kacu.org. I'm Greg Strawn, and you're listening to Conductor's Notes with the Abilene Philharmonic on KACU.
This is KACU's 40th year on the air serving Abilene in the big country. We've got some fun things planned to celebrate our birthday throughout the year. One of them is a series catching up with our former student hosts and reporters. Today we kick it off with the first photojournalist we hired, Shelley Womack, who was a hard-working, reliable student for nearly 3 years.
Hi everyone, I'm Shelley Womack, and I was a photojournalist at KACU from October 2021 to May 2024. I loved working with so many nonprofits and attending local events to shed a light on the good happening in our community. Whether that was the Black Heritage events or maybe working at the CAF Festival, it was always a lot of fun to go out into the public, meet with our viewers, grab interviews, and just learn all the different stories that are out there. I think one of my favorite stories has to be about how locals saved a stray dog with porcupine quills in her mouth. It was a terrible situation that turned positive and a redemption story filled with good-hearted people just trying to make a difference in their community. During my time at KCU, I developed valuable skills in reporting, writing, communication, and planning that helped me reach my goals today. Specifically, reporting for the Abilene City Council really helped prepare me for my current position. Being able to sit in those meetings each week and see how the city works really helped me in what I do today. I remember when I first came in, I was very nervous and just looking to try something new. And although photojournalist wasn't a job at the time, Heather gave me a shot and made that opportunity happen. Now that department has grown to include some amazing photojournalists in addition to the host and the behind-the-scenes crews, and I've grown into an award-winning journalist. I also really enjoyed fundraising week and volunteering in the community at Winter Light Fest. That was just an amazing time to get out and get boots on the ground and help our community. And now I'm working at KTAB KRBC News as a digital media producer, doing what I love every day. And KCU was that branch that helped get me here, and I'm forever grateful for the opportunities it gave me. And if you're looking for a tight-knit group of people wanting to make a difference in the big country through media, look no further. Because KCU was my introduction to news and taught me news judgment, among many other skills that I use on a daily basis. And even if you don't pursue a career in this industry, there's always something that you can apply in any future endeavor, whether that be teamwork or communication, or working separately and then coming together as a whole to be able to put a product on the table. And as a nonprofit, you can trust you're getting the facts and you're learning about all the important things happening in our community that you need to know. KCU is a viable asset not just to Abilene Christian University or the city or the county, but the big country as a whole. I want to wish KCU a very happy 40th anniversary, and here's to many more.
Thanks to Shelley Womack, former student photojournalist and now award-winning digital media producer for KTAB KRBC. We'll post the video Shelley sent on our social media at KACU895 on Instagram and Facebook. Over the next few weeks and months, we'll be bringing you more updates from KACU's alumni who played such a key role in KACU's ability to serve this community. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next Wednesday at noon with George Levesque in the host seat. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. The West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from producer Caleb Legere and digital editor Calvin Claiborne. I'm Heather Claiborne.